Well, to Iraq now. Armed men posing with severed heads, massacres of mosque-goers during Friday prayers, massive reliance on transnational jihadists. They're crimes that are normally associated with the Islamic State militants. However, they're also the actions of some of Iraq's growing Shiite militia organisations, which are playing an increasingly prominent role in fighting the Sunni jihadists. That's a quote from an article for Foreign Policy analysing those lining up against the militant Islamic State group. Some of these groups will be relied on to make advances against them, supported by airstrikes by the US and its allies. The article was written by Philip Smith, who's a researcher at the University of Maryland, who writes the Hezbollah Cavalcade blog, which focuses on Shiite Islam militarism in the Middle East. He's been telling me about his analysis of these militant groups.
I mainly focused on the Badr organization. Badr had been a militant arm that was almost completely controlled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran, and it's been used to kind of grow off little tentacles, little new groups within Iraq. All of these organizations generally fall under the rubric of Iranian control. Ideologically speaking, they believe in a concept called absolute wilayat al-faqih, which was created by Ayatollah Khomeini in his book, Islamic Government. And this is essentially the governing system with some modifications that's used in Iran. And, you know, it's a pan-Islamic ideology.
So when the Secretary of State then says that there's a role for every country to play, including Iran, it makes the Secretary of State sound somewhat behind the curve, that Iran is already there playing a role in numbers in terms of advisors, money, proxies, personnel.
Correct, correct. And I mean, they've been there for quite some time since the American invasion. They had gotten into government during the American invasion, you know, Badr, through Skiri at the time when it was called Skiri, and then IFCI, got into a number of different ministries, including the Ministry of Interior. They worked closely with some police elements and military elements, elements of the ISF. So, I mean, the influence has been there, and it's only grown, allowing Maliki to stay in place. You know, maybe there was a grand bargain between the United States and Iran at some point. I mean, I don't have evidence to it, but it seemed logical. And Maliki had, you know, essentially put a lot of these Iranian proxy groups under his State of Law Coalition header, and had worked with them after, you know, the Americans pulled out in 2011.
So would you go so far as to say that in the fight against Islamic State, that there's a real danger that the conditions might be restored that gave rise to their advances in the first place? In other words, Sunni people around the Anbar area feeling the sharp end of Shia sectarianism and throwing in their lot with people they saw as being effective against that.
Well, there's always that possibility, and I do believe these groups, as they become more entrenched, will likely continue the sectarian behavior. I mean, I haven't really seen it stop. I mean, part of the problem is, you know, I think the editors for my article put that it's just as big a threat as IS or ISIS. I mean, I would argue that the threat levels are different. The Shia militia groups are far more intelligent in terms of hiding crimes or any of their kind of misdeeds than some of these ISIS guys.
But and what kind of crimes are you talking about?
Well, if we're talking about sectarian ethnic cleansings, that was going on with elements of the Mahdi army, splinters of the Mahdi army, Asaib Ahl al-Haq, another splinter of the Sadrist movement, which is under the control of the Iranians. They were cleansing sections of Baghdad. They were running death squads, the Badr organization, through certain police groups. I mean, this was leaked out in 2006, 2007, 2008. They were running death squads through ministries that were under their control. But you don't really hear much about it because there's that trapping under, you know, officialdom that, well, they're in the Iraqi government, and, you know, maybe things are a little hazier. This is not a non-state actor, which is, you know, blowing things up, you know, blowing up markets and killing inordinate amounts of innocents, and we can see this all the time in the news. It's been a process, and it's been a highly organized one. I mean, one could argue that's what happens when you have a state backer and you have a grand strategy. So, I mean, there's a lot of levels of complication here. On top of that, you know, most Iraqi Shia, when I say most, I mean the vast majority, don't support Iran's, you know, ideological plans. They just don't. And a lot of the people who are joining these groups, they're not ideologically educated. You know, they are just Shia who want to defend their country. They want to defend their homes. But then that makes a wonderful opportunity for, you know, Iran to co-opt that urge and possibly re-educate them. We saw this in Lebanon with Lebanese Hezbollah.
And if Iran is seen to gain greater influence or hit a tipping point in terms of regional influence, it's also reasonable to assume then from the other side of things that Saudi or Qatar might seek to redress what they see as an imbalance by funding again other hardline Sunni elements. We could be into a real seesaw of a proxy war.
Correct. I mean, I think we've kind of seen certain levels of this in Syria. It's important to remember that a lot of these organizations, which are now, I mean, I'm talking about the Iranian proxy organizations, and I mean direct Iranian proxy organizations, which are ideologically loyal, were sending fighters to Syria, where they were fighting proxies, you know, certain Sunni Islamist proxies of the Saudis, of Qataris, I mean, you name it, it runs the full gamut. And a lot of these fighters, these Shia Islamist fighters, came back to Iraq and are now fighting there.
So what is this then in terms of the front that's been assembled to fight ISIS? From your analysis, who they'll be doing business with? Is this willfully naive or just simply a cynical hiding of exactly the partners that are going to have to be used in the fight against ISIS?
I seesaw on what the U.S. really wants, and it even confuses me. And I talk to, living in D.C., and I work on this stuff, you talk to a lot of different people. And I would say the United States officially does not want to work with the Iranians. And there are a lot of people who, you know, were active in Iraq who would never work with the Iranians because they understand that the Iranians are playing, you know, a double game. It's not like Iran likes the U.S., and just because there are common interests, it does not necessitate that they're even going to work with us. I mean, it's classic. Back in June, Kitab Hezbollah, and this is after Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, issued a statement where he said there should be no American intervention. So what is Kitab Hezbollah, a group which actively targeted the United States, is a registered terrorist group by the State Department. They issued a statement and said, you'll remember what happened when our Mujahideen attacked you in Iraq the last time you were here. Now, one could debate, you know, is that just rhetoric? Is it just this? Is it just that? But it's clear that, you know, they didn't really want us there. But then you have another wing of people who would say, well, no, the administration is looking at this from, you know, a big picture, grand strategy kind of angle. And because they're looking at it that way, they may see that the Iranians are going to maintain some, you know, their own level of stability. They're fighting a non-state actor that opposes the United States. And you know what? We're just going to have to bite the bullet and deal with them. I mean, there's some evidence that maybe that's going forward because there were American airstrikes outside of the besieged town of Amirli, which is a Shia Turkmen town. And oddly enough, one of the primary forces that was being used was Kitab Hezbollah to help liberate that town. And we were launching airstrikes, I mean, ostensibly in support of the Kurdish forces that were on the ground. But, you know, it indirectly aided these other groups moving in. You can really make the argument either way.
And which feeds into this other concern that we've seen in Syria, that if you supply the moderate rebels in Syria, the weapons and equipment will fall into the wrong hands. This issue of weapons and equipment has already happened there, except it's just on the Shia side.
Well, on the Shia side, in terms of weaponry that was used by the Iraqi government that they're now using, yes. And it doesn't mean that official Iraqi forces, you know, they need to bolster forces they believe are allied with them. And what ends up happening is when you have these Shia militias, many of which are directly backed by the Iranians, yeah, they're going to give them armored support at times because, you know, you saw how the Iraqi army essentially evaporated after the Battle of Mosul. A lot of their equipment was easily acquired, not just by ISIS, but by these Shia militias. I mean, one of them, Saraya Khorasani, they have a logo that looks exactly like Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So they painted over these Humvees, and they put that new symbol on the side. This is now their Humvee, a armored Humvee that we gave to the Iraqi government. I mean, it's really hard to believe since, you know, some of these groups were, you know, actively targeting those vehicles. So, yes, there's been a transfer of equipment in that way and a utilization of it. So, I mean, it's definitely a two-way street.
Philip Smith, researcher at the University of Maryland.